This is the monthly meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, and we're a nonprofit organization. We've been in existence now for 11 years. It's kind of amazing. Well, Chance was talking about how long he's been practicing law, and I'm talking about how long the organization's been in place, and it's a good long time. And during that time, I believe Axtell has made some very major improvements. Certainly in California, but also around the country. And so we have these monthly meetings in case this is your first monthly meeting. The idea is to share information and also to give you hope. So Chance is a fount of information and experience, as am I. And the fact is, in addition to that, we want you to know that somebody cares. That's really important because a lot of people in the registry don't know that. And time after time in phone calls, I'm told I feel so alone. I feel so isolated. And so we're here to let you know that you're not alone. If you choose to self-isolate because of COVID or any other reason, that's certainly your choice. But the fact is, we are here for you as an organization. Chance and I are here as legal representatives. So let's go ahead and get this meeting started. I guess I haven't really introduced myself in case you don't know who I am. My name is Janice Bellucci, and I am the executive director of the Alliance. I am also a civil attorney. And with me today is Chance Oberstein, who is president of the board of directors of the Alliance, as well as a criminal defense attorney. So, Chance, I know you spoke a few minutes ago, but a lot of people weren't online. Is there anything else you want to say?
Just good morning. Welcome to our meeting, and thank you for joining us. I'm sure more will join us as we go along, but let's get things started.
Okay. Something, isn't there a song? Let's get this party started.
Let's get this party started.
Okay. All right. So, folks, we are going to do something a little bit different today in that there are two people who wanted to make short presentations today. One of them is a presentation about moving overseas, and that gentleman's going to go first because he is in Germany, where he has moved permanently, and he wanted to talk about his experience a bit. And then we have another gentleman who will talk later in this meeting about, in general, about social media and how he has successfully gotten himself removed from a lot of social media sites. So I don't know if you all know this or not, but that in addition to being on the state's Megan's Law website, there are many, unfortunately, privately owned websites out there who also list information about registrants. And a couple of them that I know off the top of my head are Home Facts. And then there's one that's called SOR Archives. So I can't wait to hear from that gentleman about how he's been able to successfully get himself erased. And I know before the official meeting began, we did talk a little bit about one of the callers early on brought up the issue of, how do you get forgotten? And I don't think that's the way he posed it. But anyway, the idea is that in Europe, there are countries where there is, quote, a right to be forgotten. And if you think about that, I mean, doesn't that make a lot of sense? When you make a mistake in life, why should you have to wear, that badge on your forehead for the rest of your life? In this case, members of our community, the term sex offender or worse, that people, some people want to basically, label you for the rest of your life. And we're here, by the way, to tell you that you don't need to own that label. You can erase it yourself. Other people may call you that, but that's not who you really are. Okay, so let's go ahead. Before we go on to the issues here, Chance, why don't we talk about scams? And I'm thinking maybe you'd like to start that conversation.
All right, yeah, sure, I'll do that. You're going to get phone calls and from all kinds of scam artists, and I'm not just talking about attorneys that are trying to solicit you and things like that, because they're the biggest scam artists. But let me talk about the ones that really get under your skin and kind of drive you to the kiosk, if I may phrase it that way. You'll get calls where a police detective will tell you you missed a court date. There's a warrant out for your arrest. There's all kinds of explanations you'll get as to why you need to immediately come down and post some kind of money for bond or put up some kind of money for something. And usually it is that they have it set up to where it sounds like a police agency. The person talking to you sounds very much like a law enforcement official. The difference is that instead of coming down to the office, and going through what would be standard protocol, they want you to go to a kiosk and pay some money immediately, and they don't want you to get off the phone until you accomplish that task. And that, my friends, is a scam. Anytime you get a call that compels you to do something you wouldn't otherwise do without the normal protocol, which is, if there's a warrant out for you, or, you know, you missed a court date, one, you'd probably know it. And two, they don't waste time calling you. They just come and pick you up and take you. Okay. That's usually the normal protocol. If you're lucky to get a courtesy call and, you know, it says come down to the station, that's great. But the truth is that no police officer, not in this country, and especially not in the state of California that I've ever heard of, is going to have you go down to the ATM machine, withdraw cash, and then deposit it at a kiosk. So beware of these these scams. Don't fall for them. Feel free to call our numbers and talk to us during the interim. I've had people call me in the course of the whole thing, and they have one phone where, you know, the scammer is called them, and they use their wife's or their girlfriend's or their friend's phone to call me, and I listen in. I can't believe what I'm hearing, but, you know, I call the scam. Okay, it is a scam. Beware of it, and beware of things that are like that, because they will mutate over time. But anytime someone's trying to compel you or force you to go to a kiosk and post some money or else, you know right away, just reeks of scam.
Yeah, thank you, Chance, for that, sharing that information. I will say one of the stories that I've heard multiple times is that somebody gets a phone call saying, we lost your DNA, your DNA got damaged, whatever it is, you need to come in for, you know, give us new DNA. You know, that in and of itself maybe would not be a tip off, but what Chance was talking about should be, which is, I mean, what many times they tell you, don't get off the phone. Don't leave the phone, stay on the phone. Go right to, you know, your ATM, go right to, you know, the store and go get a gift card. And then they have you read numerals, you know, off the gift card. And so unfortunately, Chance and I are aware that there was a registrant, in fact, who paid $10,000 to somebody who was a scammer. And folks, if you pay money to the scammers, you are not going to get that money back. I'm sorry to say. And I've heard different reactions from police departments. As far as if you call them and say, hey, I've just been scammed, somebody took my money. Everything from, well, we don't care, all the way to, all right, come in and file a report. But these folks don't really tell you who they are. And so I know sometimes they say, I'm Sergeant so-and-so, or I'm Detective blah, blah, blah. I think they've been watching too much TV, quite frankly. But the fact is, when they do that, that's not really who they are. Sometimes they even leave phone numbers, which is fascinating, but I understand they're not the real phone numbers. And so the police can't track them down that way. But Chance and I are available for you all if you get a call like that. And just understand, the minute that they demand money from you, just hang up. That is the easiest way to get rid of the scammers, is you just hang up on them. And maybe it's rude, but guess what? They're worse than rude, right? They're basically trying to steal your money. Okay, so the first person that we have as a guest speaker today, I'll call him that, has joined us from Germany. And I know that I saw him on a few minutes ago, so I hope he's still on. His first name is Darren. And Darren, if you're still here, if you would unmute yourself. Darren has just recently moved to Germany permanently. And he has a very interesting story to tell, which he was going to share with us. Maybe this is him now on iPhone.
Actually, it's me on computer.
Okay, great. You are here, though, Darren.
I am.
Excellent. Okay, so Darren, why don't you tell folks your story here? And folks, I think this is a really interesting set of circumstances, and it's something you may or may not want to follow yourself. But if nothing else, it's an interesting story. And so we've asked Darren to limit his presentation to 10 minutes. But if you have a question of him, go ahead and ask. Okay, Darren.
Okay. All right, thanks. Well, appreciate it, Janice and Chance. Hi, everybody. My name is Darren. I've been listening in on these. I've asked a couple of questions in the past. But I don't think I've appeared and talked at all. Situation really quickly for me. I was convicted of an offense while I was in the military. It was a court martial. Spent some time in the brig, got out. I was in California. was on the registry. Really didn't have any problems. From there, I moved out to the East Coast, to Virginia. Was a little intimidated by moving. I think, as a lot of you probably realize, moving from one location to another is an intimidating thing. Scared, even if, you know, nothing happens, there's still that fear. Fast forward a few years, I'm married, have a great job, and my wife had an opportunity to take a job over in Europe. So we went ahead and did it. That did mean a few things, and I contacted Janice and talked to her. So for those of you who have asked questions about, do you need to get a new passport? I've heard the stories. I went ahead and got my new passport. I did submit a letter. And that letter, I just laid out fairly plainly why I was asking for the passport, that I had contacted my attorney, and my attorney said that I was required to request a passport with the unique identifier in it. Now, we all know how Janice feels about the unique identifier. She hates them. I do, too. And I also hated the idea of saying, I did this, and I want you to put it in there. That's why I worded it the way I did, and that was fine. They went ahead and got my passport to me. Didn't take very long. Didn't get held up. Didn't get any further questions on it. And we planned our move. We moved, and this was something that was coming up pretty soon. And we'd only been here about 2 weeks now. So a little over a month and a half before. So well more than the time that you're required to notify your local agency. Even though I was moving, I notified my local agency that I was going to be moving and traveling overseas. Now, there is not a requirement to notify anybody if you're traveling overseas. That's been, you know, one of those things in court, but I was still registered and by law required to notify that. I don't know if any of you have had a chance to do that or not. I'm going to share my screen, if that's okay, Janice.
Yes, go ahead.
Actually, it looks like you've disabled that feature.
I'm sorry, somebody set up the defaults for me. I can't change them. Please just go ahead and speak to it, Darren, whatever.
Yeah, well, that's okay. I can forward you the thing I wanted, and I know you can actually present it at that point in time. It was just the notification of international travel of a sex offender.
Okay.
Just so everybody can see what it's like, because I know not everybody gets a chance to see that, unfortunately. You know, some agencies sort of hold that near and dear and don't want anybody to know what's on it. It's like some super secret thing.
So, Darren, you're talking about the form that the federal government uses. Is that right?
Yes. So this is United States Marshal Service, NSOTC, and that's what's required by your local agency to submit. It's pretty simple, pretty straightforward. It actually comes with directions and little drop-down menus that you can walk through. But it's some pretty basic information. I will try to, I'll just walk everybody through it really quick just to tell you what's on it, just so you understand. It's nothing really outrageous, doesn't ask you to justify anything, doesn't ask you to write a letter. What it does ask you is your name, information about you, your citizenship, place of birth, your purpose of travel, and on there it's just a drop-down window, business, vacation, military, relocation, deportation or other, how you're traveling, what your departure location is, if you're returning, what your arrival location and time is, destination country and where you're going to go. A hotel is perfectly fine. And then the details of conviction, or what they ask for is the dates, jurisdiction, what offenses you were convicted of, victim information, and the jurisdiction of current registry. That is the only thing that's really required in the form. The other is contact information and destination country, so how they get a hold of you, and any other information like itinerary, visa information, and stuff like that. For me, it was pretty simple. I was relocating permanently, but I did provide them what my itinerary was up until the time I was leaving, to include my flight number, because that's where you're supposed to put that information. And then you give that to your registration authority. You do not submit it personally. It goes to the registration authority, and then they're the ones to submit on your behalf. So that's pretty simple. The intrepidation gets, and I hear this all the time in the meetings, is, okay, well, can you travel? The answer is yes. What happened to me? I showed up at the airport, got my ticket, showed my passport, got on the plane. We flew business class because we were flying overseas on an overnight trip and retreating ourselves. I hadn't traveled in a while. I sat down, they served me a drink, and I took a nap. Nobody bothered me. There were no questions at the airport. There was no TSA follow-up or anything else. I admit I was worried. You know, I was nervous. My wife, who was, you know, sitting next to me and, you know, very supportive, you know, just told me not to worry. I hadn't done anything wrong. But it's still nerve-wracking. When we landed in Germany, the police were waiting for me when I got there. And they were very friendly. We got off the airplane. They were checking passports as you got off. They pulled me aside and said, hey, we've got a notification that you were traveling. We just want to make sure you're here. They thought my wife was actually German because she speaks a little German. So that took them by surprise. But the only thing they did is they said they took a picture of my passport, verified that I was where I was going to be staying when I first got there, my intention for being there, and that I was on the right flight. And they said, thank you very much. And I was on my way, made it to, you know, made it off the plane before other people made it off the plane still, even with that. It was right on the jetway that we got questioned and went into customs. From customs, went through. We got stopped and asked again just to provide some information. I think there was a little bit of confusion. The folks that talked to us outside the plane didn't notify the people inside that they had actually talked to us. And there was some confusion with my wife's orders because she didn't have her visa yet because she's over here under a status of forces agreement. But that took a few minutes to clarify. They apologized for the delay, handing my passport back with a stamp in it. And made sure we could get to our luggage as quickly as possible. So walked us through the back way so we didn't have to go back around and out through the big crowd. That was it. That was the extent of it.
So, Darren, I'd like to emphasize two things. So I don't know if people are taking notes or what they're doing, but two really important things. One, Darren traveled to a country in Europe that allows registrants even to come visit. Okay, so Chance and I in the past have talked about 26 nations in Europe. They're part of a coalition called the Schengen Nations. And there's 26 countries, the largest of which are Germany, Italy, Spain, and France. And then there's 22 smaller nations. And so if you want to go visit those nations, you will be allowed to go visit those nations. Now, Darren, your situation is different in that you're moving there permanently. And that's fine too. But one of the important things, another important thing that I think you said, Darren, was you gave them the information about where your temporary lodging was because you didn't know where your permanent lodging is. So you went basically from the airport to a hotel, I believe. And so you gave them the hotel information. Is that correct?
Correct. That's correct.
And so the federal government, basically at this point in time, you're beyond the jurisdiction of the U.S. federal government. And so when you change locations, you don't have to notify anybody in the United States. Is that also correct?
That is also correct. Once I arrived here, that was all that I needed to do. I notified them. The biggest important thing was I followed the rules ahead of time. Notified them what I was going to do, was very upfront with them what I was going to do, and made sure I kept copies of all the paperwork we did when I did that, and the email trails.
Right.
And I have now moved from there.
Just a minute, Darren. Darren, I'd like to emphasize another point, and that is Darren has a unique identifier in his passport. And he's right. I don't like unique identifiers, and I think it's very sad that anybody has to have one, much less they have to request it. But that's what I'm recommending to folks right now, is that if you are on the registry due to an offense involving a minor, and you're required to register, go get a unique identifier added to your passport, even if your passport hasn't expired yet. And, you know, the horror story that I have to tell is one of my clients who went to one of the 26 Schengen nations, or he was, you know, ready to go there, and he had already boarded the plane, his suitcase was, you know, packed and everything. I'm sorry, already on the plane for him and his wife. And he was basically taken off that flight because he didn't have a unique identifier added to his passport. And Department of Homeland Security said, oh, by the way, we revoked your passport. And yet he never got any notice that it had been revoked. So, Darren, you did all the right things. You dotted those I's and crossed those T's. Do you want to talk about the one little hiccup that happened, though, after you departed?
Yes, there was one little hiccup that happened after I departed. So my daughter had given me a call. So I obviously left the state of Virginia, I'm no longer a resident there. And my daughter called me and said, hey, Dad, you're still on the, still listed as being in Virginia's system. Sent me a screen cap. I went ahead and I called Janice and asked her, hey, what's your advice for this? At the same time, I reached out to, or shortly thereafter, I also reached out to the person who I had been doing my registration with in the state of Virginia, who was, by the way, who was very helpful. We always had a great relationship, never harassed me. Janice was able to call a lawyer that works in the Virginia state police system. So he works for the state police in Virginia. They were able to then go in and realize that was a mistake that somebody did. Instead of removing me from the Virginia registry, they had just changed my address to my hotel in Germany. And they were able to finally remove that. So I'm now no longer in that system. The key portion of that is, well, one, it's a great thing to be off of that system. The other key is by staying in that system, I was technically required to be visited, which they would have gone to find me and wouldn't have been able to. I'm required to have gone in and re-registered, which I would never have done. And if my daughter hadn't have told me that, I wouldn't have known about it.
So, Darren's absolutely correct. He was still on the state registry on their Megansaw website, even. And so I was able to see that myself. And then the good news is that I had worked before a couple of years ago, actually, with an attorney who works for the Virginia State Police. And I was able to contact that attorney and police officer and said, you know what, you told me a couple of years ago in writing a letter that they wrote to the federal government, by the way, saying once you leave the state, you're off the registry in Virginia. Now, not all states are that way, folks. And that's why Chance and I are always telling you, please be very careful and register in the smallest number of jurisdictions possible, because not all states are that way. And New York State and Florida are certainly two states where if you ever register, they don't want to take you off. So anyway, Virginia fortunately has a different policy and law there. And that one police officer who's also an attorney was able to assist Darren. But having said that, it still took, I think it took us about 10 days to get it resolved. So
yeah, about 10 days. And I'll say that California is also a state that does remove you. Yes. I was in California. I was registered there when I got out of the brig for the Navy. Mm-hmm. And when I left there, they did remove me as well.
There is at least one takeaway. And I say this because I've spent about a decade moving clients all over the world doing this kind of work. And one, Darren, you did exactly what you needed to do. Okay. And that was really good. But the missing piece here, which is where the glitch came, is that once you're settled, once you've gotten settled and some time has gone by, maybe very short time, you always need to follow up to make sure that what you did happened actually. And it's very important to have someone on the other end, like an attorney or someone who can go on and check it for you. Not what happened with you is you found out through happenstance and then you had to react. But what part of your plan should have been to follow up and check the jurisdictions you checked out of to make sure you were formally checked out of them. And that's the takeaway from all this. Everything else was perfect.
Yeah. I will actually say too that I actually had called Janice. She had checked for me. She had warned me against checking myself and warned my wife against checking on my behalf in my presence. So I think that's why my daughter did. And I probably would have gotten back around to asking Janice, but it probably would have been a month or so after we had gotten really settled. In this case, my daughter was able to let me know within a week of me arriving.
Okay, that's good. Because that's the follow-up plan. And so if you had that in mind, your plan was solid. If anybody missed anything, ultimately a month or two down the line, you check again. Because really nothing's happening for a while, and so you've got time to do it. But the best thing about the follow-up plan is that you follow up. And that worked out fine for you. So congratulations. I'm glad everything worked out.
But for those of you that are fearful, I understand it. I was too, was nervous. I mean, every delay in the plane, you know, something was happening, you know, we're just waiting for traffic. And I'm like, ooh, am I going to be that person that, you know, somebody has nothing better to do but harass people and want to be some sort of vigilante and, you know, stick it to the people that are the evil ones in the world, according to them, is going to come try to mess with me. That didn't happen. And the treatment I got by officials in Germany was nothing but polite, respectful, and friendly.
Isn't that amazing, folks? To be treated with respect. I just think that the officials and stuff in those 26 countries, they must just shake their head and go, those crazy Americans, what were they thinking, right? And causing such harm. And really, I believe that Germany is one of the nations where there's a they think flowing from the right of privacy is the right to be forgotten. And that's how it should be everywhere. So Darren, thank you so much for that presentation today. You've really given people some concrete information. When you get a chance, please go look at the chat. There's a couple questions for you over there. And you might just answer them privately, unless they said to everybody.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah. No problem. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, so that's kind of new and different for us to do something like that. But I want to encourage others. If you have a story to tell like that with some important information to share with others, please talk to Chance or I ahead of time so that we can make the proper arrangements and fit you in. Darren, we put him at the beginning of the meeting because for him it's in the evening in Germany, and so I think he's going to go eat dinner now and live his life. But it was great that he was willing and able to share with us before he did that. So, I'm not encouraging people to move overseas, but I know some people who have successfully done it, and Darren's one of them. And as Chance noted, you know, Darren really did a good job of it. And, you know, so please, if you're going to make a decision like that, make sure that you prepare yourself before you do it so that you don't basically get in trouble with the U.S. government right before you go to the foreign country. So we'll be talking some more about travel, both overseas and domestic, in just a little bit. But before we go there, I want to talk about an issue because we have somebody on with us right now. Let's see, two things. Let's talk about the military lawsuit. So it's really important, folks, that we have filed a lawsuit on behalf of a registrant who was also a military retiree. So Joe, if you don't mind taking a bow right now, maybe you can wave your hand at everybody or something and unmute yourself. Yeah. So I'm a Navy veteran myself. I did not choose to make it a career, but my hat is off to, and I salute people who in fact did make it a career, because there are a lot of sacrifices made during a military career. And so, and I remember when I was on active duty, there was those incentives, right? Hey, just stay in for 20 plus years and, you know, we'll take care of your needs medically, come shop on base, you know, and not pay sales tax, and be able to buy other things, groceries and other things at the base exchange. There's all kinds of MWR, morale, welfare, and recreation facilities that are available to you, et cetera. And all of a sudden the policy changed very abruptly on November 1 of last year. And so without any due process whatsoever, all of a sudden people who are military retirees were being denied access to military bases. And Joe, I just thought you might want to share briefly, you know, what happened to you, if you would.
Thanks, Janice. I was actually on my way to the base clinic to pick up some medication that day. And quite to my surprise, when they scanned my ID card at the gate, they turned me around and said, you can't come in, sent me over to pass an ID, which is just outside the gate. And after about a 30-minute wait or so, they told me that I could not come on the base and gave me a kind of a form and said, here's what you can do to get access, but that really didn't explain what was going on. And The letter was just for kind of a generic letter for if you need access, this is what you have to do. And it took a little bit to, I had to ask a couple of questions to find out and ask if it was something that stemmed back to 1992. And that's when he said yes. So I knew that it was for my previous conviction. And, you know, that as Janice said, after you're retired, a lot of your life is based on your military career. I would do most of my shopping out at the base, especially at the base commissary, because the prices are less expensive there. And you go out there for the other activities that they have, the fitness center, use of the medical facility, things like that. I hadn't seen a civilian doctor since I was 21 years old and went into the Air Force. So it's really quite traumatic, but it has led to this lawsuit being filed with Janice's help and the Family Safety Foundation. We're hoping that that can make an inroad into this situation for all registrants and perhaps be an inroad to making changes to federal law.
Well put there, Joe. Yeah, folks, if you think about it, I mean, Joe was convicted of a sex offense, but it was a very long time ago, 1992, as he said, and the offense did not involve anybody in the military, and it didn't take place on a military base. So how is it, right, that Joe can be posing a current danger to people on a military base? It just, there's no logic there whatsoever. There's multiple written policies out there, and when I say multiple, from different services, and one of them, which is actually from the Marine Corps, it specifically said that they were going to notify people before they sent out before they started doing this. And I've only heard from one person so far who got a letter. And by the way, it wasn't before November 1 of last year, but after that, considerably after that. But most of the time, people are just being denied access to military bases. And I really hope that the courts can understand and, you know, appreciate the importance of people like Joe, who spent 20 plus years on active duty, serving our country, putting their lives at risk, and, you know, promising them, well, gosh, gee whiz, if you only give us those 20 years, we're going to give you all these benefits, and then basically to sweep them away for any reason. And without notice makes kind of like, you know, adding salt to the wound. So we are planning to file another lawsuit. I believe I found a plaintiff who's just as good as Joe, you know, and Joe's a great plaintiff, by the way, because of his circumstances. And the other plaintiff is actually in the state of Virginia. And with his situation, you know, similar to Joe's, his offense was a long time ago, his conviction. The fact is that it didn't involve anybody in the military. It didn't take place on a military base, et cetera. And, you know, he, by the way, the other gentleman, too, has a service-related disability, 100% service-related disability. And like Joe, he's being denied access to military bases for treatment. And it's just wrong. So it's a steep mountain to climb, folks. We know that anytime you sue the federal government, it's a steep mountain to climb. But you know what? There are mountains out there that need to be climbed. And again, you know, I was talking earlier, Chance and I both talking about sometimes you might lose a lawsuit, but it's worth trying. And sometimes in one lawsuit, you gain some information that might help you in the next lawsuit be more successful. But Joe, I really am optimistic that we will be successful in your lawsuit, and that if we are, that it will help a whole lot of people. Again, people who have been denied access to medical care, dental care, you know, going to the base exchange, the commissary, and all those other places where you were promised that you could go a long time ago. So thank you, Joe, for serving as a plaintiff in that lawsuit. I mean, we cannot file these lawsuits, folks, without having a plaintiff. So sometimes as the organization, we are a plaintiff in the lawsuit, right? But we're rarely the only plaintiff. And in Joe's situation, it was very, very important that he agreed to serve as a plaintiff. And I talked to a lot of people before as an organization, we decided that Joe would be the plaintiff. And as I said, we're going to have a second lawsuit. It's filed on the East Coast in the state of Virginia, but federal district court there involving somebody who has similar circumstances to Joe's, and different military branch, by the way, too. So Joe's was filed against the Space Force base at Vandenberg in near Santa Barbara. It's hard for me to say that. I actually worked for the Air Force as a civilian attorney, and we didn't have Space Force bases at that point in time. So, but anyway, Vandenberg, they actually do launch rockets and missiles from Vandenberg, and it's a great place to be, but it's not a great place when you're a retiree who's depending on base for your medical care and other benefits. Okay, so if anybody has a question about the military lawsuits, I think this is a good time to ask it. And again, thank you, Joe. Maybe that was a little bit, I hope it wasn't depressing. I hope you get the gist of it, that in fact, what we're trying to do is get military retirees access to military bases. Oh, Darren's got a question. So our comment. Okay, Darren.
Yeah, hi, quick question. In whatever's been happening so far with the case, have you figured out what system the military's DBIDS, for those who don't know, is their biometric system that all the ID cards are connected to, what system they're using to connect to get the information on the registrants?
Not precisely, Darren, but what I do know is something changed in the technology so that the DBID system that you referred to could in fact be connected to all the sex offender registries in the country. And so the policy, by the way, that they say that they're affecting is basically saying that anybody who's currently on a sex offender registry cannot have military base access. Okay. And so when I worked for the Air Force as a civilian attorney, I was working government contracts. That's what I was doing. And we used the DBID system to look at individuals and companies that had basically done something wrong. And sometimes, you know, and so they weren't eligible to bid on a contract. So it's really strange that they're now connecting, right, the sex offender registries with the list of contractors. It, in some respects, it doesn't make sense. And what's happening, based upon a whole lot of people explaining their circumstances, is they come to the front gate, you've got some junior enlisted person who, you know, with a rifle, by the way, to tell you you can't come on base, who doesn't even know why you can't come on base. And I think Joe mentioned that in the beginning, he didn't know why he was being denied access.
Yeah. What I can say is, so DBIDS is now, probably because they just changed the name because people like to keep the acronyms, Defense Biometric Identification System. Last year, they went global with that, where it was a stateside system only, and started off with the Army and then rolled out to a bunch of other bases. And you used to have to register locally. Now DBIDS is global for all military bases, including over here in Europe. And it's tied into the DEERS system, which is Defense Registry System, which where anybody who's in the military is retired, is a veteran who has access, is a dependent, you know, spouse and stuff like that is all registered. So that's where I know they're getting their information for the personnel side of the house. When I was in Virginia, I did go on base to get a new card because my wife is retired, Navy. That's where we met, and I was able to get on base to get that, but I didn't have the ID at the time. So it was getting on base with just my driver's license, and they didn't really care. They just scanned hers. I am over here in Germany now. I have yet to try to go on base. We will see what happens. I'm trying to give it as much time as possible before I take and cross that bridge. You know, trying to use my ID card to get on base just to see how long it takes for all that stuff to wash out of the system. That's why I was asking.
Okay. Well, thanks for that question, that information. Thank you very much. We have two more hands up. Michael W.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So, my question is, and I've been asking it, are you including the guard as part of the lawsuit?
The lawsuit is only against Vandenberg, the base commander. So we kept a pretty narrow focus here, but we believe that if we're successful in this lawsuit, that other bases and services will be affected.
My reason for my question is, okay, so my wife is active duty, We've mm-hmm. been to your meetings in Los Angeles many times before. We moved over here. We're at Fort Stewart in Georgia.
Okay.
I'm a disabled individual, my wife, so I have to use the base. Being a dependent, we have to use the base specifically for our medicals and stuff like that, except for specialists that are farmed out of base. Mm-hmm. So here, when it rolled over, I got pulled over, and they pulled me over, and they ran me completely, and they came up with nothing. So they just said you're restricted from base. Go over to the guest shack, guard shack, like Joe said. And when I got there, immediately after handing my ID, and I informed them while I was there, they walked me into another room and handcuffed me.
Oh my gosh.
Immediately. And told me that I had to wait for the MPs. Just before that, I had called my wife, who was on duty, to come over to witness all this and stuff like that, just so that they knew that, you know, hey, I was a dependent of somebody on base. And I spoke to the major of the guard there, and they very specifically said it was them, the guards, not the base, that was restricted. And then we went to the provost marshal and spoke to them, and they literally told us that the base had no problems with me being on base. My wife had went through all the paperwork, everything. And it is specifically the guard, which in my digging around finds they are part of the Homeland Security or something, is who they're run by. They're specifically away from there. So that's why I keep asking why, if you're going to do the guard.
And well, wait a minute. You've raised a really good important issue, and I promise to look into it. I don't think I've heard from anybody yet from the National Guard, and I think you had.
No, ma'am. No, not National Guard.
Oh.
No. They're called the Guard of the Army. They are the guys in the blue uniforms that stand at the gate. They're the guys that run the DBID system. They're the actual people that actually run that system that block people from going on and off base.
Okay. I promise I will do that. I think we need to move on to the next caller,
okay.
Please.
Okay.
So no Jim, worries. Jim S, you've got your hand up. Jim S.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I think he might have answered part of that question. He was talking about you're disfiling that lawsuit against Vandenberg, but the question that I had was basically it's the care package that was signed in effect by President Trump was supposed to be for veterans, and I am a Vietnam veteran, but I've been told by several people that I cannot get on the base. And I haven't really tried yet because I figured I'd get turned away. So do you have any input on that? Is that anything that – I do know one person that lives in California that is not on the registry that did 26 years for murder, and he's got a – he goes on to the base all the time. They don't ever question him. And so I'm thinking that – he gets away with it. I should be able to, but not necessarily.
Well, I hope, I mean, it's a sad state of affairs, quite frankly, that somebody convicted of murder gets treated better than somebody who's on the registry. But we know that. I mean, for example, there's no registry for people who've been convicted of murder. There's no registry at all. So logic and reason when it comes to the registry, unfortunately, is often absent. But yeah. Thank you for that information. I think Michael W. needs to say something new. I hope it's something new, Michael. Michael, you're muted. Can't hear you.
Okay, so in speaking with them, I asked them about that. I specifically asked them, I said, why are you guys singling me out and such like that? And he specifically said that they are going after everybody, DUI, murder, assault, anybody with a violent is what they told me, the major of the guard told me.
Well, I know that we don't have the policies for all the services at this point in time. We do for a few of the services, and they are not totally consistent with each other, which makes it even more difficult challenge, but we'll do what we have to do as we can do it. So Jim S, are you not finished speaking, sir?
No, I was trying to get my hand down, and I'm sorry. I apologize for that.
Well, that's all right. I can lower that your hand for you. Okay, so folks, yes, I'm glad that we got a chance to talk about this issue, and now, quite frankly, we need to move on. So let's move on to let's talk about the American Law Institute in just a minute, but I was going to let somebody take a bow here.
And four.
He's not in front of his thing right now, in front of his camera. So we'll come back to him. So let's talk about the American Law Institute, because there's not a whole lot to say other than I am totally run out of patience with the American Law Institute. I don't know how Chance feels about this, but it's been watching a professional tennis match. The ball moves faster, a lot faster than a professional tennis match than the ALI. But still, that here we are, you know, more than a year later with no results to report, no final results to report. So, you know, way back in June of last year, the ALI members, they brought forward a model penal code, which was going to be wonderful and remarkable and awesome. And it was going to be something then we could take to our state legislatures, as well as the federal government, saying, hey, look at this, what the ALI is recommending. It was going to significantly reduce the number of offenses that required registration. It was going to limit the duration of registration to no more than 15 years. It was going to do wonderful things. And then it got watered down once, right? When it went to the ALI leadership, they call it their council. That happened in May of this year. And then the council watered it down even more. So it needs to go back to their membership. And where it got watered down again. So, folks, it's just watching this, and it's kind of like a death by a thousand cuts. So, in our board meetings, we've decided to stop reporting about it because there's nothing real there. It's definitely lost its momentum, and possibly it's lost its value. What do you think, Chance?
Well, yeah, this is something we've discussed prior, and I think I said we needed to view that whole process with caution, because, you know, there are some real progressives that are trying to move the ALI in the right direction. But there's also pushback by you know, the old guard who you know, they just disagree with it. And they're in positions of power. And, you know, the compromise pretty much waters it down, whittles it down to next to nothing. That's why I was cautiously optimistic. I understand these things because I've watched them happen in the past with other processes in criminal law and procedure. So I'm not surprised. I was hopeful it would work out, and that would have been my prayer, but it didn't. And so I'm disappointed, but you know, it was somewhat predictable given all the actors that composed that world of ALI. So, you know, maybe we'll get another pass at it, but at this point, doesn't look too promising.
So, does anybody have a question or a comment about ALI before we move on? Somebody's written us a comment here. The legal industrial complex has taken charge. that's quite possible. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Is that a conspiracy theory or what is it?
Perhaps. All right. So the second person who was going to make a short presentation today has reminded me that he's waiting to make that presentation. Right before he makes it, though, and his first name is Tim, I want to announce that another person who's gotten off the registry just a few days ago. So maybe at this point in time, Doug, do you want to raise your hand, or you can unmute yourself and talk about how it's felt to be free of the registry for at least a couple of days? Okay, Doug, we can't hear you yet. You're going to have to unmute yourself. No, not yet. So he's on iPad 2022. Doug, we still can't hear you.
How about now?
Yes, we can. That's wonderful.
I just learned how to use the telephone a little while back. This computer. Now, being off the internet is similar to being out of jail, I think. You know, it's a lot of other people are celebrating it as much or more than I am.
So. Well, I want to congratulate you. And Doug lives in San Luis Obispo County, and which is actually the same county where Frank Lindsay lives. And Doug had a very positive result this past week. The judge granted his petition. And, you know, Doug, you were very fortunate in that you got a tier assignment, even though your conviction is quite old, not as old as Frank Lindsay. So it is what it is, folks. But I'm happy to report that we have one fewer person on the registry as of this past week. Actually, two. Another one of my clients, too, got off the registry this past week. And he lived in, I have to check here, he lived in Stanislaus County. And he was the first person that I represented Stanislaus County. So anyway, it's happening, folks. Lander Chance is representing many people successfully, too, in the petitioning process. And folks, if you know anybody who's on the registry, please tell them to call Chance or call me, and we can talk about whether or not they're eligible. You know, the statistics coming out of the Sex Offender Management Board last, it was June 16 was their meeting. You know, they reported about how many people have filed petitions, how many petitions have been granted, et cetera. And the numbers are really low. It's about 2,600 people. This is statewide in almost a year. Only 2,600 people have filed petitions. And I think that more than 40,000 people are eligible to apply for removal, and only 2,600 have. So there's a disconnect there somewhere. And anything that you all can do, maybe if you're part of a counseling group or anything else, you can say, hey, you know, if you think you might be, or you're just wondering if you are eligible, contact Chance, contact Janice, you know, and talk about the process. And the first step in that process, quite frankly, is getting a tier assignment letter. So if you have a tier assignment letter, it's so much easier to represent you because you have the Department of Justice opinion there about what tier you belong on. So it's not that, you know, Chance, I know you pulled a rabbit out of a hat in Los Angeles, and that was great, and convinced a court there to grant a petition without a tier assignment, but that's not been my experience. And anyway,
it differs from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and it differs from, you know, place to place in terms of who's you know, the district attorney, who's the judge. Like Janice, I've had some great success in this, and the thing that really is gratifying is very similar to, you know, very similar to what's happened today with Janice's client. I had someone who was on for 37 years that's been relieved recently, someone that was on for 36 years the same week. That, I mean, if you add that up, you know, that's a lot of registration time. And I say that only to say this, if you know, a lot of people are discouraged from coming forward because they think, I don't want to rock the boat. I don't think I can make it. I don't think it's going to happen. I had one person approach me in Orange County of all jurisdictions and said, you know, I just don't think so. And you know what? I almost agreed with them because, you know, the amount of convictions was like ridiculous. It was like 27 convictions for one case. But I got to tell you, he was successful. And that is to say that if you're apprehensive and you think that you can't make it, talk to somebody first. Because you know what? Things are happening all over the place with this. And I think that the reason the numbers are down is because people are apprehensive about coming forward, or they just don't think they qualify. They just don't know how this whole thing works, and they're fearful of the process. Don't be. Use it. It's there for your, you know, for your advantage. And, you know, you need to take advantage of this thing and push forward and, you know, not be fearful of the process. I know it's intimidating because courts and judges and prosecutors are, but don't be afraid of it. Just do it.
Hello, Janice?
Yes.
Can you hear me? This is Doug.
Yes, we can.
Okay, one of the things that I wanted to say to anybody that's trying to get off the registry here is hire a good attorney. Without your help, I don't know if they would have... with you being on board there, they knew doggone well that they were going to get sued if they didn't release me.
Well, thank you, Doug. I appreciate that commercial. Yeah, and I will tell you that it does help to be represented by an attorney, even in the beginning. And I've had a couple people, I've worked with a couple people who thought that they wanted to file their own petition. They probably could have done it. But the fact is, when the DA's office, when local law enforcement sees that you're represented by an attorney, I think you get a little better deal out of it. And I know, okay, even if you do file your own petition, folks, please, please, please go hire a lawyer if the DA objects to your petition. So I'm working with somebody right now who did file his own petition, and sure enough, the DA objected to it. And now he's hired me to take care of it. But, you know, it's a bigger mess than it would have been otherwise. He messed up one of the details. So anyway, but it's not something to be afraid of. They're not going to make you register twice just because, because you submit a petition at all. I sure want to get as many people off the registry as possible. Again, I think at least 40,000 people are eligible. And according to California's Sex Offender Management Board, only 26 people have filed. And by the way, of that total of 2,600, 1,183 petitions have been granted. 108 petitions have been denied or dismissed, including that there was no tier assignment. And there's 1,418 that are pending. So I did a little quick calculation, and I believe about 9% of the petitions have been denied or dismissed. But that's a pretty low ratio. And again, I think some of them at least were dismissed because they didn't have a tier assignment. So Tom, it looks like you got your hand up. Do you have a question or a comment for us?
Brief comment. I'm off the registry and have been since January. I applied in this state back August of 21. So it took 6 months, and I did it on my own. However, I would recommend having an attorney. I simply could not afford one. However, I did get advice from unofficially some attorneys. And I stepped in it a whole lot of times before I finally got it right. The fact is, just hours, 2 hours before I walked in, I had the wrong form. And so I was in a mad scramble over 2 hours to get the right form and get copies made and take it in. And actually, the hearing went really quick. The judge asked me 4 questions. He said, granted. I had been on the registry for 20 years. And so I'm very happy to be off. Since that time, I have had a couple of interactions with police officers, and it's quite odd, even being off the registry and having everything, to my knowledge, cleared. Apparently, I'm still visible to law enforcement officers. And so as it was involving a traffic accident, and the officer was going through, and all of a sudden it was at night, he stopped, turned his floodlight right into my face and blinked it off. I just smiled and, stepped out of the car. He come over and finished our discussion, and he put his hand out, shook my hand. He goes, "Congratulations." So he knew that I had been on, and he knew that I was now off. So apparently I'm still visible somehow or another to law enforcement. However, I'll tell you this, echoing iPad 2022, it's really fine being off the list. Anyways, that's my comment. And I would, again, suggest to have an attorney because I came very close to being denied because I had the wrong form. That's all I got to say. Thank you.
And thank you, Tom, for sharing. Okay, we're going to take one more comment or question here from John, and then we really need to move on to Tim. So,
Good John, morning. Good morning, Janice and Chance. Just commenting on Tom's experience, I've wondered and keep forgetting to ask you online and otherwise, is there a way to, there probably is a way to do this, but all law enforcement has our license numbers when we register, and those show obviously who we are or were once you get off the registry, and will subject you to scrutiny that other citizens won't get. Can we or you, or is there a process that you know of to to contact DOJ to require all law enforcement agencies to delete that information?
Wow.
No, the answer is no. The answer is no. The answer is that, yes, the reason they have it is because everything is recorded in your criminal history and otherwise. There are databases we know of and databases we don't know of. And so the answer is no, but the idea that if you've been removed from the registry and you get hassled, even if you've been removed, moves us from one, a compliance check to harassment. So think about it in these terms. If police are harassing you, okay, then you've got options other than the DOJ. And remember, police, especially police, have a history of not assisting people either on the registry or who have been removed from the registry. So if you're getting harassed, contact an attorney to handle that. I've yelled at a number of police agencies in the past. I'm not shy, and you know I'm not shy at all to confront any issues about that. I'm sure Janice isn't either. She does harassment stuff. I think that you probably want to consider getting a hold of her if that type of thing happens.
All right, yep. Thank you.
And thank you, John. Okay, we're going to move on now to Tim. And Tim has some really important and valuable information to share about how do you get yourself off of these privately owned databases. And I filed a lawsuit many years ago now and had partial success with that lawsuit. But there are other websites out there. And Tim, I know the one that keeps coming to mind is for me is Home Facts. They seem to be the most difficult. But I think you have, as I said, some valuable information to share with the group. So please do so.
Right. So first of all, I just want to thank Dennis for all that he's done for us. And I knew that I needed to hire her as my attorney to file my petition. So a little background, I was convicted of PC 288A in 1996. I didn't ever think I would ever pass a background check, which I finally did in May. In late December 2021, Janice submitted my petition in Alameda County to be removed from the registry. I received the California Department of Justice letter on May 20th that effective April 2020, I no longer had a requirement to register. So mine was actually pretty quick with Janice's help. The district attorney approved it right away, and then there was a court date set and didn't have to go to court because the judge agreed. And so it was pretty easy in my case. So after that happened, I had a family member check the Megan's Law website to verify that my information had been removed, which was the case. So the next thing that I did was a Google search of myself using all of my various names to identify all the websites that I was on. And there are a lot of reputation clearing websites that will charge hundreds to thousands of dollars to clean your internet information. But I recommend that you do this on your own first. Because the process is not as onerous as people would have thought. So the websites that I had found my name on were arrestfacts.com, offenderradar.com, homefacts.com, truthfinder.com, and mugshots.com. The process that has to happen in order for Google to no longer be able to search it is that your profile on all of these different websites has to be removed. And so to give you an idea, there's essentially four search engines that have 98% of the market. So Google has 87.71% of the market. Bing, which is Microsoft's search engine, has 6.72% of the market. And Bing also supports AOL's search engine. And Yahoo has 2.92% of the market. And then the last one is DuckDuckGo, which has another 2%. So the priority for me was really Google and Bing, because that's 90%, 94% of the market.
And so the process is, first you go into these websites and you request to be removed. Just, you know, there's a arrestfacts.com has an information control link, hard to find, but it's underneath your picture. And you click on it and you tell them that you're requesting to be removed. You just tell them you're no longer required to register. And then once you're removed from the site, then you can request from Google, Bing, and Yahoo what's called a request to remove outdated search results. And what happens is that these search engines, they go out and they search millions of websites in order to create the search results. And the process for Google is fairly easy as well. So I actually was surprised at how fast I was able to get off of arrestfacts.com, offender radar, HomeFacts also. And then within 2 to 5 days, I was no longer being searched. My negative derogatory information was no longer on Google. And I had to, I did the same thing with Bing, and that's 2 to 5 days. The problem that comes up is that with Yahoo, they don't do their, they don't refresh their search engine. They say no more than like 2 to 3 months. So my information is still showing up on Yahoo search engine. And the thing is that you'll see within the search, the underlying information of the web page that no longer exists. So fortunately, Yahoo's on the low end of search engines. So I'm hoping that within whatever their refresh cycle is, that I'll be off. But the people think that it's not possible. The ones that are still pending are TruthFinder, which is based in San Diego, so they should know that they need to remove the information, and mugshots.com. And TruthFinder is based in California, according to their Whois information and their contact information on their website, and mugshots.com. Don't know where they're located, but I understand that their founders were actually arrested a few years ago for extorting money from people. But they don't do that anymore. I think what they're doing is they're stating it's an arrest record. It's not the listing from the Megan's website. However, because I know the picture, I know what I was wearing when I was arrested, it's not the same information. They used the Megan's website to pull their information. They did not use my arrest record to pull the information. So that is my in to tell them, hey, you need to remove my information because it's inaccurate. It's no longer correct. And I know you, and I stated in my email, I know you pulled it from the Megan's website because I know what I was wearing when I was arrested, and the picture that they have on their site came from when I registered in 2010. So the thing is, just don't be afraid to just go out and request that your name be removed. The one thing that, the one place that I did have to pay was truthfinder.com. It's a paid site, and essentially they have a search engine within their paid site that is a database. So they created the database, and it still shows that I'm on the registry, which is not true. So I've sent them 2 emails to request to be removed. And I also stated that Janice is my attorney. So hopefully that'll put the fear of God in them. I paid $28 for it, and I can cancel it before the end of the month, so that I no longer have to be a member. But TruthFinder seems to be a source for other websites. So that was important for me to actually really work to get information off of that site. So it's not impossible. You can do it yourself. You don't have to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars to clean your internet information. I had tried to do it in like 4 years ago, and a company wanted to charge me $3,000 to clean my internet information. But because I'm on Megan's website, these websites will not remove my profile. So didn't want to waste the money. And so that's really important. Once you're off once you're off Megan's website, which is the source of information for these other sites, you can then request that your profile be removed. And what that means, a profile is essentially a page on their website, and it ends with .html. That HTML page is then removed from their website so that when Google does a search, it can't find it. Now, if their information still crawls and it says your name is on their site, when you click on it, then their site says page not found. That's when you then go to Google and say, remove outdated search results, because if their page no longer exists, Google has to correct their information.
So
I started this about 3 weeks ago, and really 95% of the information is gone.
Okay, Tim, there is a request in the chat area here to list the names of the websites that you were talking about. So if you have an extra minute or two, would you please do that over there? And then some people, I could see a couple of people were taking notes, and I myself was having trouble keeping up with the names of all of them. That would be great.
Okay, yeah, I could do that.
Okay, appreciate it. Thank you.
These are the ones I found when I did a Google, Bing, and Yahoo search of myself.
Okay.
And that's what you want to do, is do your own Google search after you're off of the Megan's website.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you just put them down there. Thank you.
Hold on. Let me, I have to do that again, because it actually just went to you. Okay.
Sorry. Okay. While he's doing that, somebody else here in the chat room said they use a service called recordgone.com, that service removed him from a large number of sites for less than $200. Another possibility there if you're not a do-it-yourselfer. So anyway, Tim is doing that. So, okay.
Yeah. All just, right. Just be careful. You can also be scammed with these reputation sites. Mm-hmm. You don't have to spend thousands of dollars in order to clean your reputation on the internet.
Yeah. Thank you, Tim, for sharing that really important information. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and move on now. I think it's a good time for us to talk about the SORNA regulations. So just a little bit of background information. The SORNA regulations, it's like this huge drama. Maybe it's a telenovela, I'm not sure. But it started last year. It started in October of 2020 when the federal government issued proposed federal regulations that would, in fact, affect people on the registry. And we, as an organization, got together with other attorneys and other legal professionals, and we prepared a response to those proposed regulations. Our response was over 30 pages long. It was very lawyerly. It had lots of footnotes and case citations. We were very proud of it, weren't we, Chance?
Yes, we were, and yes, we are.
And guess what? The federal government disregarded what we wrote. By the way, we were one of over 700 responses they received regarding their proposed regulations. They didn't pay attention to anybody else's comments either, no matter how lawyerly or well-written they were, with one very small exception. So in January of this year, that's when the federal government finalized their SORNA regulations. And it's the biggest mess that I could ever imagine. It's kind of like hornet's nest, right? And or it kind of reminds me too of the character Pigpen in Peanuts comic strips. Remember Pigpen? He's always there's always these clouds of dirt that are surrounding him, because we don't really know what those SARNA regulations mean. There's so much uncertainty. It's like trying to, fly an airplane with very limited visibility, maybe in no visibility. So that to me is the biggest problem with the regulations. It's a lack of clarity. They're too vague. They're ambiguous. Oh, by the way, you're not supposed to issue regulations that are vague or ambiguous, and they managed to do both in one fell swoop. So, so a lawsuit was filed by the Pacific Legal Foundation, and they've become a partner of ours. And Axol signed a formal memorandum of understanding with the Pacific Legal Foundation, in which we agreed to be a plaintiff in the lawsuit. We also have a John Doe who's a plaintiff in the lawsuit, and the lawsuit was filed in late May. I believe the date was May 27th. And a week later, a motion for a preliminary injunction was filed. So that motion, there's a hearing scheduled on July 18th at, I believe it's 9:30 in the morning in Riverside in Federal District Court. So if you want to join the hearing, you can. I believe you can do it remotely, or you can be there in person. And I know I'm going to be there. I think Chance, you said you're going to be there if you can. We've got some other board members who will be there. And it's really, really an important case. And the motion for preliminary injunction is really important as well, because if this motion is granted, then the enforcement of the SARNA regulations will basically stop. Now, wouldn't that be wonderful, right? And somebody's like, well, how can one federal district court stop what is happening around the country? And I'll just say, when it came to COVID, right, and whether or not we were required to wear a mask on an airplane and other places as well, and all it took was one federal district court that said, nope, don't have to do that. All of a sudden, people took their mask off. I understand in some cases people were in the air and the pilot announced you don't have to wear a mask anymore. So anyway, that's what we're hoping, a very broad decision here. You know, is this judge going to have a backbone and make a potentially difficult, challenging decision or not? Who knows? We have appeared, Axol, we've appeared before this judge twice before. And once the judge ruled in our favor and once the judge did not rule in our favor. Now, the facts were not the same in both cases. And I do believe this judge is fair, and I believe he does have a backbone. So I think that we'll get fair treatment from him, but that doesn't necessarily mean we'll get success. So, Chance, I'm sure you have something you want to add about the SARNA regulations, and then why don't we just go ahead and open up to questions and comments. If you have a question or comment, put your hand up, please.
Just a quick comment before we start, and that is that this is so important, that day is so important, that that's my birthday. I will be there.
Okay? Oh, my goodness.
So, that's how important that is, because if it wasn't that important, I'd probably be riding my motorcycle down the coast. But I will be there on that day. Okay, second of all, it really does impact all of us. Okay, maybe not so much within California right now, but you enter into interstate commerce and you've got issues, which means you travel internationally or you cross the state line. So it's a very important date. I hope as many people as possible get there to listen in. I hope that preliminary injunction is granted. It will free a lot of people up until this issue is settled. And I think it's a winning issue. It's a separation of powers issue. And I think we win on this one. So I'm hoping that the judge sees it that way and grants that preliminary injunction.
So folks, I mean, one of the very basic things that it places in question, and Chance and I were very experienced attorneys, 30 plus years, each one of us practicing law. And we can't answer the questions out there. For example, how often do you have to register? Now, I mean, in California, most people register once a year. That's it, annual registration. People who are transients, homeless, they register every 30 days, but most people register once a year. These SARNA regulations put in question whether or not many people will have to register four times a year. And let's just take the biggest group of people on the California registry are people convicted of Penal Code Section 288 parentheses A. lewd or lascivious acts with somebody who's under the age of 14. The SORNA regulations would require everybody, more than 40,000 people in California, to register four times a year. Not once a year, but four times a year. And I mean, that's ridiculous. California, one of the reasons that they passed the tiered registry law was because the police officers and offices knew that they were wasting a lot of their resources basically monitoring people who did not pose a current danger. Think about it. Again, I like to pick on Frank Lindsay because his situation is just so extreme. Convicted in 1979, no offenses before, no offenses afterwards, and yet he's on the registry, right? And not only that, but up until recently, the people in San Luis Obispo County where he lives, they come do a compliance check on his house, sometimes twice a year. People dressed in SWAT uniforms. You know, Frank has lived in the same house most of the time he's been on the registry. And it's like, what the heck is going on here, folks? So we know it's not based on logic. We know it's not based on reason. But again, somebody like Frank Lindsay, who would in fact have to register under the SORNA regulations four times a year, what's going to happen if he goes to his registration office 3 months after his birthday, right? And says, okay, I'm here to register again. I just sort of anticipate they'll throw him out and say, well, we're not going to register you. We don't register people four times a year. We only register you once a year. So part of the reason that Chance and I are so concerned about you is what's going to happen when and if the federal government wants to make, you know, an example of somebody who doesn't register four times a year, even though if you had tried to register in California four times a year, they would just throw you out. So I hope it doesn't happen, but I'm afraid that it's going to happen. And the other thing is the SORNA regulations require a reporting of a lot of information that here in California, our state doesn't require. And what do you do when you try to take your registration officer all this information? And they're like, well, why are you giving this to me? I don't have any place to put it. I don't care about it. I'm just going to throw it in the trash. Well, then it's like, well, I tried to comply with the federal regulations, right? But it was impossible to do so. And so when it's impossible to do so, that is a defense under the regulations. But frankly, my concern is you'll be arguing this from a jail cell.
Well, you know, yes. Even more than that, who cares about the defense? And if anybody who knows anything about criminal law knows that it takes at least $100,000 to defend a federal lawsuit when it comes to criminal law. Who's got that kind of money? I mean, come on. And the other thing is that for the first time, it puts the onus on individuals, not the state. Okay, so, you know, it's the federal government telling you, not the state, because states have decided, hey, we're going to follow or we're not going to follow. We're going to comply or we're not going to comply. So the federal government's going, I don't care. You, individuals, you've got to comply. And how are you going to do that without a state noticing you, you know, without knowing what to do? I mean, it's ridiculous. And so, but the ridiculous part about it is there's some very serious laws out there, like failure to register, that can cause federal jurisdiction to take hold if you cross state lines or you travel internationally. And that's a concern because, you know, that's the easiest way to get hooked up and become the first test case. And that worries me very much because it almost makes California and the perimeters of California like a prison where, you know, you're contained within the state, but you can't leave it. Otherwise you're looking at some pretty draconian measures taken if you don't comply with a federal law you had no idea. It's crazy. It's insanity. So, you know, we're hoping to get to the bottom of that.
I thank you, Chance, for that. And folks, we are extremely fortunate to be in a partnership here with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Trust me, we've been, working away here for 11 years, but the fact is that the Pacific Legal Foundation's been working away for about 50 years, 50. And guess what? They have their financial resources are things we can only dream about someday, but we're not there yet. So they have, I believe, 40 plus attorneys that are on their staff. We have two of their attorneys actually three are listed here, of the Pacific Legal Foundation attorneys who are working on this case. They've already told me from the, you know, the first time that we met them with them about this, that they plan to take it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court if they can. So this is something, you know, it's a really small chance that this could, this case could overturn Smith versus Doe, but it might be the next chance, the only chance that we have in a while. So I'm really feel confident that we're working with a well-resourced organization, an organization that cares. And you know what? What they really care about is the separation of powers issue that Chance brought up. Maybe not so much about people in the registry, but the separation of powers issue is a really big issue. And it's something that Pacific Legal Foundation has cared about for a long time. So again, July 18th is the hearing on the motion for preliminary injunction. If it's granted, it'll be huge. If it's not granted, by the way, it's not going to make that big a difference because it's just status quo. So we won't lose anything by the Pacific Legal Foundation trying for motion for preliminary injunction. And there's a huge possible, and I underline the word possible, payoff here. So I don't see any hands raised about questions or comments about the SORNA regulations. So maybe we'll just go ahead and move on. Chance, we talked a little bit about overseas travel when Darren Keeter was talking about his trip to Germany and his permanent move to Germany. But I'm just thinking maybe we can talk now about domestic travel. Would you like to lead that off?
Well, sure. I'll say a few things, and I'm sure there will be some questions regarding it. Domestic travel, you know, as opposed to international travel, is domestic travel is travel within the United States. Every single state, just think of them as a jurisdiction, has their own rules about those who are registrants traveling from one state and visiting their state. So if you're a registrant in any particular state and you plan to vacation or travel or go to another state, you're now traveling domestically. And there are certain rules and regulations that apply to the road, which is every jurisdiction requires different things. It's kind of like a mishmash of all different types of laws, state laws and local ordinances and whatnot. But the main thing is that you should know that states differ and that one state may require you, if you're a visiting registrant, to register within that state if you're going to be there any longer than 3 days. Another state may say 48 hours. Some states may say, okay, 10 days. But in order to really stay out of the fray, which means in order to really protect yourself, you don't want to register in any of those states. You want to stay long enough so that you stay to the point where you don't have to, which means you want to leave before you're required to register. Sometimes that means leaving for a moment and coming back, depending on whether or not the state allows so many days to do that. You want to check each state to make sure that you're complying with those rules and regulations, but not registering. The name of the game is to go have your visit and to enjoy yourself, but not to stay long enough to be hooked up. And the reason why is because there are some states that will keep you on the registry forever, even if you do leave and you do deregister out of that state, even if you were there for a moment. And that's a problem because let's just take Californians, for example. If you're living in California and you're looking at relief and you're eligible and otherwise qualified for it, but you're registered someplace else like Florida and you get off in California, you're still a registrant in Florida, even though you don't live there. I know that sounds like an anomaly. It is kind of like an anomaly, but it's true. And so that's going to impact you for a lifetime. And so before you do something that's going to complicate your life and keep you in a place where you don't want to be, it's good to lay out, you know, your itinerary and know what's required in each state and avoid having to register there, you know, not staying to the point where you have to. And I'm sure Janice has a few other things she'd like to say about that.
Right. Thank you, Chance. Folks, just understand how many details there are out there to be aware of. Again, so you meet the goal that Chance stated so clearly, which is you don't want to register in any place that you don't have to register. And the deadlines for registration or the triggers for registration vary very widely from 24 hours. If you go to Rhode Island and you're there 24 hours or longer, you're going to have to register. Okay. But if you go to Hawaii, I'm understanding off the top of my head is you can go to Hawaii for 10 days without having to register. So, you know, plan ahead. I guess what we're trying to say is plan your trip ahead so that you avoid registration. And by the way, with Hawaii, one of the problems is also you can't be there more than 30 days in a calendar year, or that triggers the registration requirement. So think about Rhode Island. Thankfully, it's a really small state. And so if you're going to go to Aunt Martha's house for Thanksgiving in Rhode Island, stay in another state nearby, right? You can stay in another state nearby that has a longer requirement before you have to trigger, rather, before you have to register. So with careful planning, it can be done, but it does require careful planning because, you know, two things. One, if you overstay your, you know, if you stay past the trigger date, then what's going to happen is you can get a failure to register if you don't register there. And it's just like a failure to register in your home state. You know, at least in California, if you're convicted of a misdemeanor, it's a misdemeanor offense. But if you're convicted of a felony sex offense, it's a felony failure to register. And by the way, too, a failure to register will impact your eligibility here in California about when you can petition for removal. It adds years to your eligibility requirement. Okay. So and then the other thing is, and we have some people who are currently registered in more than one state. Most of them seem to be registered in Florida or New York, at least the ones that I'm aware of. And folks, you can't get off those registries, is my understanding. So in general, though, I'm not an attorney licensed in New York or Florida, but the fact is I know a lot of people who are in California who are eligible to petition for removal, and I can tell them, hey, this is what to do to get off the California registry, but the fact is we cannot promise you, and we can't, Chance can't promise, I can't promise, that it's going to affect your registration requirement in another state. So that's a whole reason why to avoid registering in any extra states.
Well, one other twist to this too, and this is what Janice and I were talking about before, the SORNA regulations. If you're planning on leaving for more than 7 days, SORNA would require you to report that to your local registering agency before you go. Otherwise, you fail to register under federal law. Okay. And if you fail to register under federal law, you know, you're looking at up to 10 years in federal prison. That's the nuance. The new nuance that's bothering me. And so that's why I say, you know, you've got to be very, very careful about these things. You know, most people leave for longer than 7 days when they're going on vacation and they're doing domestic travel. And so SORNA at this point, and unless we get a preliminary injunction, is something that you really must be concerned about.
And it looks like we have a question or a comment from RJ.
Yeah. Hi. I wasn't, quick enough to raise my hands on the last round of questions about the SORNA. Okay. But so we have the ability to get off the registry in California. That's great. That's awesome. But with SORNA doing their thing, could they go around that and just not recognize, because they're not recognizing our registry system, or the potential of not recognizing it. Would they do also the same with our getting off the registry? And they say, well, you're still on the federal registry, but even though you're off the state, you're still on our registry. And so that's kind of where my question.
I'd love to get the first shot at that, because I've been thinking about this. And I'm just thinking about it. But think about it this way. I'll just give you an example. Say you're relieved of the duty to register in California. Okay, so now you're no longer a registrant in California, but you want to travel internationally. Okay, if you travel internationally, you're still required under SORNA, even if you're not registered in California. It would appear, and this is where it gets a little murky. It would appear that you still, you know, once you hit, you know, the state line, once you leave. You're traveling internationally, you know, all that stuff kicks in. I mean, it seems to me when you read the statute, the SORNA statutes, you're still obligated to follow it. Okay. And that means this. That means for people who are in California, here's the anomaly. People who are in California, at least registering when they travel, they're still in compliance because they're registering. But those who have been removed from the registry that SORNA doesn't recognize as removed for their purposes. So let's just say a person who would have done, say, tier two or even tier one, 15 years, okay, and they only registered for 10, and now they're traveling international because they've been removed, you know, and, you know, who's to say they're not the first case to be tested? I'm just saying it's murky. And so what it does is people who have gotten relief in California now have to worry about, you know, domestic travel and or international travel because of the wording of these new regulations, okay? Yet people who are registered, okay, don't necessarily have to worry about that. They just have to be in full compliance of it when they travel one way or another. So you've got in international travel, if you're registered, you follow the rules. And in domestic travel, you know, if you have to give notice because you're going to be gone longer than 7 days, you have to follow the rules. Of federal law, will they be recognized in California? Will California agencies comply and assist you? Questionable. And that puts all this into this big gray area. So who knows? Janice?
Yeah, Chance, I agree with you. And to me, that's the biggest threat of the SORNA regulations is what do they mean? How are they going to be interpreted in the future? Actually, remember I said the motion for preliminary injunction had been filed. Well, the government's opposition to that motion, I got a copy of it just a few hours ago, right before the meeting. And I'll just read to you a couple of sentences from it, which addresses this very issue. So this is what the federal government says. SORNA does not require registration if a conviction has truly been nullified. Truly been nullified. Although continued registration may be required under both SORNA and California law, where an offender remains subject to penal consequences, plaintiffs identify no injuries resulting from the rule. What a bunch of hogwash.
This is what we've been discussing this. I know everybody, when you read that explanation, it sounds like, what the hell is that? Okay. We've been discussing this, and I've brought it up in meetings beforehand where, you know, the DOJ did an evaluation of California, and the attorneys general and the evaluators said California dismissals have no penal consequences. Therefore, they take you out of the definition of SORNA. And so I understand the language they're using there, but they're not using it precisely. And I've got to tell you something about this. I've looked at those evaluations and I've evaluated those evaluations, and the Department of Justice missed some stuff. Okay. And they got some things wrong. I'm not taking away from their saying that a dismissal takes you out of the definition, because an attorney general, a very good one, Gonzalez, looked at it and that's exactly what he said. Okay. And I understand that it's kind of ticky tack stuff because they're looking at the petitioner's situation in this case, not necessarily the main issue, which is separation of powers. But it is kind of a funky explanation, and it's hard to make heads or tails out of what they're saying. It's weird.
I think that they're chasing their tail in this language. I mean, they say in here the rule does not change existing law. Well, if it doesn't change existing law, then, you know, why did they issue these regulations in the first place? And they're saying, oh, well, we're not changing anything. And says, you know, and I read part of one sentence. I'll read that part of the sentence again, and then I'll read the end of it. Plaintiffs identify no injuries resulting from the rule, nor can they justify emergency relief like a preliminary injunction, where the rule imposes no new requirements. I mean, what a bunch of hogwash.
Are they crazy?
They are. They went to a whole lot of trouble to put together, to propose final regulations, to supposedly sort through over 700 responses to the regulations, and then to finalize the regulations. And yet they're saying here, oh, the rules don't impose any new requirements. I mean, to me, that is just total nonsense, and I'm being kind. Okay, JD, you've got your hand up again. Please unmute yourself.
Hi. Yep, hi. I got it. Could you put all the information for the July 18th hearing on the website so that all of us who would consider going, do you know if they're going to limit the gallery or?
It's a pretty big courtroom. I've been in it before. So if we could fill up the courtroom, that would be like awesome.
Okay. Well, if you can put that up, you know, the time and You know, downtown Riverside can be a pain to park in. So,
not to mention anyway. It's going to be hot. Okay, so those are all good points, JD. I promise to put on the website probably shortly after this meeting.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I also will post the government's opposition. We already have the motion for preliminary injunction on the website, and I'm going to go ahead and add the government's opposition. And all I can say is just might need to take a couple of aspirin or something after you read it, because it just doesn't make any sense. It, tautology, so that's answering a question with a question. You know, I mean, that's what's going on here, and they're just chasing their tail, and it just doesn't, it's not even a logical argument. So I have confidence in this judge and that he can see through this nonsense. And I might have to eat my words later, but I think we'll get a fair hearing. RJ, do you have any questions, sir?
Yeah, now that I found the raised hand, but just one quick other thing to possibly suggest an area of approach to these websites that I guess a lot of them don't list the picture anymore, but maybe the name. But I got the idea from a neighbor who was kind enough to drop a printer or a poster of me that they had printed off of Megan's, I believe it is. And they even protected it in a cover, a protecting sheet, so it wouldn't get wet from my sprinklers. But okay. The idea is that I believe it is a crime, it is a misdemeanor for somebody to bring up the fact that you're on the registry unless they're trying to protect somebody or whomever, minors, whatever, but they're supposed to have a constructive purpose for it, not use it to harass you. These websites, I know they're a corporation, but a corporation is a person. And that person, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is committing a crime, albeit a misdemeanor, by doing this, because they're not serving a constructive purpose. They're just putting it up there. They're not putting a warning. Watch out for these people, if I'm not mistaken. It's just that we're there on there. So that might be a good way to approach that, maybe. I don't know.
Well, I will tell you, I mean, these websites differ quite a bit from one to the other. And so one way that the websites get away with this, if I can use that language, is the First Amendment. Okay. So if they report that you've been convicted of a sex offense, it's true information and you can't do anything about it. But if they say something more than that, like this person's dangerous or whatever, then that gets to the area of like, well, but not necessarily. Right. And that's of course a big issue for all of us. You know, does a person pose a current danger when somebody like Frank Lindsay's been on the registry since 1979 and hasn't reoffended? I think it's easy for us to make the argument, and I think someday a judge will listen to know Frank Lindsay doesn't pose a current danger. Do you want to add anything, Chance, before we move on?
No, I think we've exhausted that topic, but you know, good discussion.
It is a good discussion. So, folks, we're now going to talk about the tiered registry, I think, in some greater detail. Before we go on to there, I guess it's time for me to make a commercial. And that is, in fact, to encourage folks to make a donation to the organization. Chance and I are here. We're volunteers. We don't get paid for doing this every once a month here. We're happy to do it. We're happy to share information with you. But the fact is there's other expenses that the organization has, including keeping the website up and running, etc. So if you think that you're learning anything of value today, please make a donation. It's easy to do on the website. Just press that donate button, and you can do it through PayPal, or you can do it with a credit card, and that will keep the engines running here. So another thing I'm going to ask, please, if you're not speaking, would you please mute yourself? So somebody just coughed. I just muted you. And one person, I kept trying to mute him and it wasn't possible. So I just removed him from the room. So, you know, sometimes there's background noise and really we want to be able to hear each other speak. And so if you're not speaking, please mute yourself. Okay, so let's talk about the tiered registry law here in California. It's been a wild ride already, but I will say, you know, this month is the end of June, marks the first one complete year that the petitioning process has been in effect. And I mentioned a statistic earlier, and I think it bears repeating. This is from the Sex Offender Management Board. And according to the Sex Offender Management Board, only about 2,600 petitions have been filed so far. And I just think that that's like less than 10% of the folks who are eligible. And I'm, you know, Axel, we as an organization, we keep trying to get the word out, but we need some help here with you all and the word of mouth. So you go to counseling groups wherever you, you know, are. Maybe when you go to register, you can talk to other people there at the registration office and say, hey, you know, you too might be eligible. And hey, wouldn't that be great if you're eligible to be, and you get successfully petitioned for removal, you'll never have to repeat this process again. So, okay, so the about 2,600 petitions have been filed. About 1,200 of them have been granted. About 100 of those have been denied. Additional petitions, and then we've got 1,400 that are pending. So I will just tell you that the counties and the courts, some of them are in great shape. Like San Diego County is in great shape. They are really, you know, they really figured out ahead of time. They spent time ahead of time, because they knew that this tiered registry was coming. The law was passed in the year 2017, for goodness sake. And so they had 4 years to prepare, but most counties didn't bother to prepare. And I just tell you, I think Los Angeles County is the least prepared of the counties that I've dealt with so far. And one of the things that I think a mistake that LA County made was, instead of having one judge in one courtroom make a decision about all of these petitions, which is what they used to do with certificates of rehabilitation. Instead, they're farming them out to all the hinterland court houses. And so, unfortunately, clerks in those courthouses, judges in those courthouses don't seem to know what they're doing. We're getting really uneven results. And so I've had to write a couple letters to presiding judges when clerks weren't doing what they were supposed to do, basically rejecting petitions for really ridiculous reasons. And, you know, what do you do when a clerk won't do what he or she's supposed to do? And I'll just say one of the probably one of the worst situations was the judge who granted a petition, and it took the clerk 3 months after that to actually get the order filed. 3 months. So somebody spent an extra 3 months on the registry because we didn't have the court order. And by the way, it's not that just that we didn't have the court order. The California Department of Justice didn't have the court order. And because of that, they didn't remove the person from the registry. They did not remove somebody from the Megan Saul website. So there's all variety of things going on. On the other hand, I think the biggest positive surprise to me has been Ventura County. And I've gotten a couple of people's petitions granted in Ventura County in record time. I think in about 2.5 months, where the average really is closer to 6 months. Do you have an average, do you think, chance on your petitions?
No, it varies. And the reason it varies is because it's not necessarily the courts that hold up the system, although they can. It's law enforcement. Sometimes, you know, when you file, just because you file the case doesn't mean everything now is in action. The action starts when the petition gets to the law enforcement agency. Okay, that starts the clock. They got 2 months. And then once they notify, it's not the court, it's they notify the DA's office. The DA has 2 months, whether to oppose or not to oppose. And some DAs want to contact other agencies. You know, this is why, for me at least, jurisdictionally, it's really, and it depends on each jurisdiction. Funny, some jurisdictions, funny as it may be, do the service of process first and then approach the courts, which is totally contrary to what you're supposed to do. So every jurisdiction is different, time elements are different, and on individual cases, it's different. And you know, sometimes there's glitches in just small areas. What I try to do is follow up and make contact with each person doing each thing during the whole process to iron out glitches so that I shorten the time that way, which means I will call up and I'll talk to the law enforcement agency, or I'll call up the court and talk to the clerks, or I'll call up the DA's office and find out who the assigned DA is, because sometimes they're sitting on something that's glitching it. For instance, I had one DA that you know, she received the report, but the court didn't receive the report, and she didn't think it was her job to take the CSAR report over to the court, and the court wasn't going to set a date or go to the judge until it got that CSAR report, and the agency who did the CSAR report didn't think they were obligated but to send it to one person, and that was the DA. Now, think about that. You know, it's a bunch of mice running around. So, you know, you've got to contact these folks and get things to move sometimes. And it's because we're not unified. There's no unification of the system. That's why Janice says that San Diego's got it together, because they're unified. They know what they're doing. They have put together a system that is, you know, that runs actually and gets things done. And so, you know, every jurisdiction is different, and therefore the times vary as to how much time is taken. And if a police officer who is in charge of doing this doesn't know what they're doing, it can take 2 months just to get it out of that phase of the process. Very difficult. So that's why there's time variances.
Yeah. And it can take even longer than that. I think my worst law enforcement story, and I'm going to tell the tale of the city of Montebello. So the city of Montebello, they just refused to make a determination whether somebody was eligible. And I talked to the police. I talked to the city attorney. I talked to anybody and everybody who would listen to me. And finally, I had to file a writ of mandate. And what do you know? I got their attention. So, but that shouldn't happen. It only happened that one time. It was a mess. So we've got a person with his hand up. His first name is David. David, you're unmuted.
Good morning, Janice. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Fantastic. Good morning, Chance, also. This is David.
Good morning.
Hello. Two real quick items. First of all, following up on something you said, Janice, I am just making another donation. And I encourage everyone on this phone call to please make a donation to ASTOL. The funds are very well used. Believe me, very well used. And the second item is, on the website, there have been some questions and comments about compliance checks. And I'm wondering if you could just address that generally. There was someone named Chris, I believe from California, whose spouse is a registrant, and there were some issues about compliance checks. So, the word of the mouth directly from you would be fantastic about compliance checks. And I'll take my answers offline.
All right. Thank you, David. Chance, how about if you, answer them.
I'm not, it was kind of muffled. So
about compliance checks.
Compliance checks. Okay. Well, as far as compliance checks goes, and if we're talking in general, police come into your door to see if you are registered. You know, you don't have to answer the door if you don't want to, because you're not, there's no mandatory obligation to do that. Okay. They've got to conduct those checks in a way that satisfies them, but there's no law that compels them to have to invade your privacy or do anything like that. This is all administrative. And so the problem with these compliance checks is sometimes, you know, through open windows or through open doors, police spot other things that they think may cause them to want to investigate further. They see things in plain sight, or they smell things, or they, you know, they make some observations, and that can cause some problems. So, you know, the other thing is that in these compliance checks, some jurisdictions, you know, send out the ninjas, you know, a bunch of people dressed in black and, you know, draw attention to your door, because why would they be coming to your house? And what are they after? I mean, people are naturally curious. So you've got to find a way to, I think, work these things out that, you know, will gain compliance. We'll also adhere to respect and consideration for the administrative process. So, you know, think about this. Again, you don't have to let anyone in who doesn't have a warrant or a purpose for going in there. And you don't have to be in a position to cause people to make observations that they shouldn't otherwise be making. So you've got to determine how you're going to do it in a fashion that is amenable to you. But that, okay, also causes completion of the compliance check so that there's no further issue. And those are my thoughts on it. And if anyone wants to call me and ask me how to achieve that medium, I'll be happy to answer that. But in general, I think that covers it for me.
Okay, Chance, what about somebody who's on parole or probation?
Well, that's a whole different ballgame, because a person who's on parole or probation has suspended rights 24/7. So you have to comply. You have to open your door, and you have to adhere to this. You don't have a right not to, because you've given up that right to search, you know, to be free from unreasonable, actually, and I say this, unreasonable search and seizure. You're 24/7. Okay. So that means that you have to comply with whatever the police are requesting, which means that they want to come in and take a look. They can come in and take a look during the compliance check. And so that's a whole different ballgame. If you're on probation or parole, you have to adhere to the terms and conditions of that probation or parole. And that most likely means if someone knocks on your door and identifies themselves as a police officer, you're going to have to let them in.
So thank you, Chance, for that clarification. And I would like to share with you all an extreme example that really happened. So a gentleman who later became my client, but he wasn't at the time because he would have known better. then the police came and knocked on the door, said, "Hi, we're here to do a compliance check." And he said, "Okay, you know, I have nothing to hide." So they're like, "Well, can we come in?" And he said, "Oh yeah, sure. Come in to the house." So they came in, they looked around, they didn't see anything that was, that might give them probable cause to look inside of doors or anything like that. But they saw that he had a computer. And they said, "Oh, you've got a computer. Mind if we take a look at your computer?" And he said, "Okay, you can look at my computer." I mean, I hope you all never make that mistake. Think about it. Why would you want somebody else looking at your personal computer? The thing is, when somebody's looking at your personal computer, you don't have control over it when they're looking. And it's possible they could actually add something to your computer that wasn't there in the first place. And I was so horrified. I keep bringing this up as an example because it's something to avoid. So most of all, to avoid, again, if you're not on parole or probation, don't let them in the front door of your house. There's no reason, unless they have a search warrant. You can have a smile on your face and you can say, "Well, good day, officer. You want to come in my house? Then please show me your search warrant." You can blame it on Chance and I. "My lawyer told me to ask for a search warrant." "Oh, gosh, gee whiz, you don't have a search warrant today. Well, then you're not coming in my house today." Again, you can keep smiling. There's no reason to get hostile or anything else about this. After all, they have guns and you don't, right? But the fact is, just say, "No, thank you." You don't have to let them in the door. And I've even told people the extreme, pull the door shut behind you. Even if you lock yourself out, you will find another way to get into your home. Trust me, you know, you will figure that out. But the fact is, if they come in your house and they see anything that they think might be an indicator that a crime has occurred there, then you're toast. Because the next thing you know, they're going to be searching your whole house. And if they find anything that's illegal there, you're toast. That's not exactly a legal term, Chance. I apologize. But
well, it's a good warning. And I think that people should adhere to that. You know, you should understand that, you know, being on the registry is not, you know, this is administrative. Okay. So don't get it mixed up with parole or probation. That's a whole different thing. Parole or probation, though, that is something that that's a contract you've made, you know, with the court and the prosecutor's office and the agencies that supervise you. You know, registration is completely administrative. And, you know, you don't have to create problems for yourself by doing what you need to do. If you register and they need to do a compliance check, it needs to be done in a well-balanced way that, you know, causes you no harm.
And by the way, the purpose of a compliance check is to see if, in fact, you live there. So you have told law enforcement somewhere down the line that you live at this address, and all they're doing is seeing if, in fact, you live at that address. Therefore, if anybody asks you, they show up and they start asking you questions about the offense, you don't have to answer questions about the offense. You can say, "No, thank you. My lawyer told me not to answer those questions or give you that information. See you some other day," and walk into your house and close the door behind you. You do not have to give them more information. I do not know why they would even ask you about, you know, what it was, why were you convicted of, but I've heard multiple times, multiple people on multiple occasions and multiple places that for some reason, the officers are asking you these questions. Part of it, I think, is like the officers are there because they're getting paid overtime. So the more time they spend at your house, the more money they make, I guess. Maybe that can be one modification, or maybe they have purient interests, right? And they just want to hear what it was that you did, but you don't have to give them that information. And I highly recommend that you don't give them that information. Don't give the police any information that you're not required to give them, which basically is, yes, this is my name. And yes, this is my address. Thank you very much. Have a fine day and walk into your house. Do you want to add anything to that, Chance?
Yeah, I think they're trying to harass and humiliate you sometimes. And I think they're trying to have you talk to them in a way and in a place where other people can overhear to get the message out. So don't discuss that with them. You know, say, look, if you want to discuss those things, I have an attorney that would be more than happy to discuss those things with you. But as I understand it, you're here for compliance. You want to know that I live here? I live here. Thank you. Goodbye.
And it could be that short and sweet. So just think about it. Early in this meeting, we talked about scams, right? And how the best way to deal with the scammer is you just hang up on them. The same thing, compliance checks, don't hang up on them. Smile, say, yes, I live here. Thank you. Have a good day and go into your house. It doesn't have to be any more complicated than that. So it looks like John has a question or comment. John?
Hi, talking about this issue of the officers coming to the house and engaging in conversation. That's one of the oldest tricks in the book to engage you in innocent conversation. How have you been? What's going on? Talk about your garden, just to get you talking. Because once you start talking, you start letting your guard down. And it's really easy to slip in the question about what about this or what about that? Asking about neighbors, you know, they want to fake it like they're looking to what one of your neighbors are doing. Just saying what Janice and Chance are saying as far as don't say anything is the best thing you can do. Bite your tongue until it hurts if you have to, but don't say anything other than thank you, have a nice day, and Merry Christmas.
Even if it's July. Okay, thanks, John. All right, folks, we've been meeting now for a little over 2 hours, and I think it's time to wind things down. I want to thank you all for participating today, for showing up. You know, as always, show up, stand up, and speak up. Many people have spoken up today, and thank you for sharing. And I hope that you'll come back next week. We usually meet on the third Saturday of the month. This is actually a week later because of some personal travel plans that I had. But please join us again next month. And again, if you learned anything of value today, please consider making a donation. Chance?
Donate, donate, donate. And thank you so much for joining us today. Have a wonderful weekend. We look forward to seeing you again.
Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.